And the
podcast
begins with a song of rebellion.
How can this
podcast
be my life?
CD Burners.
All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of CD Burners. Today we're talking about one of our favorite albums. I think we both love and cherish this album because it's one of the most iconic albums in emo pop punk history. It is Say Anything Is a Real Boy.
Where do you want me to begin with this? I saw some place that they called it Jewcore.
It is Jewcore, yeah.
Which I was like, that is hilarious.
A lot of the producers that worked on the record were Jewish men as well.
Yeah, which here's the fucking thing, dude. Max Bemis was like,
something's wrong with your charger.
Yeah, I know. That's why I got a new computer.
You got a new computer instead of a new charger?
I got a new No, the computer's fucked. So I got a new computer, and I just haven't set it up yet. So just wait in there, because I fixed this one. Anyway, dude, Max Bemis was
19. He recorded this.
19, 20 years old when he recorded this. It was originally supposed to be like a concept. Like, it is like kind of a concept album, but he had originally going in like names for characters and all types of shit for every one of these songs, and he just like eventually scrapped that, which is, if you know Max Bemis, it's the most Max Bemis style thing to do, is to be like, fuck, I have this idea, I want to do this, shit, we're already doing this, scrap that, do this. It is, I think I relate to this guy more than anybody else in this scene.
Well, this is the second release from Say Anything. It is supposedly a rock opera, as Morgan said. It's been named on Rolling Stone's top 40 best emo albums of all time. It sold 200,000 copies independently. It earned the number 8 spot on Billboard's Top Hot Heat Seekers chart. Joni, our intern, put this together. She said, the lyrics are sarcastic and introspective, and the album as a whole focuses on themes of pop culture criticism and the artistic struggle. It's drenched in irony and could have only been pulled off by Max Bemis' specific and quirky voice.
Shout out, Joni. The first thing that I have in my notes, which, by the way, if you guys are like listening to these or watching these in a row, you know, the first couple ones were like our first ones. I'm like, all right, now I know what this is going to be like. Now I know what this is going to sound like. So my notes they're different. My notes are different on like what I like originally came in here being like, I'm going to fucking take apart every song and blah, blah, blah. And I want to do also kind of. But the thing about this album is that it was the first time that I was like, oh shit, like an album can be funny too. Like there's a sense of humor about this album that I hadn't heard in at least this genre of music ever.
It is funny, it's horny, it's sad. There's a whole range of emotions. As I dug into this record, you know, I read that it was supposed to be a musical theater record. It was supposed to be a rock opera. That's how he originally started it. And
he got the dude from fucking Hedwig.
He did. He brought on two producers and mixers that were from the musical theater world. We can dive into that a little bit more when we go into the liner notes. But yeah, Max Bemis played every single instrument on this record except for the drums. The drums were played by longtime Say Anything collaborator Kobe Linder. It came out August 3rd, 2004 on Doghouse Records, and then it was reissued in 2006 on Sony, reissued on vinyl in 2007, and then it was reissued in 2014, 10 years ago.
Four, 2 years after I graduated high school, I was on a motherfucking tear. This was like, I was like, yes, because it was like a lot of these songs do the thing that I like, which is like gang, like rev you up and has gang vocals in it. Like that, the first song on this album, I know we'll probably talk about like our standout tracks in this album. like supposed to be a little bit later. But the first song is, I think that that's going to be like my standout album. And it's like really, it takes you in right away. Also with the intro to it, it's his dad. He's talking to his dad and he's calling his dad and he's like, I'm nervous about fucking naming the record.
Nervous about recording the spoken word intro to the record.
Because he was, when they originally were going to do this thing, it was going to be much more spoken word. There was originally going to be like spoken word part song, spoken word part song. And so I think that probably was from the concept that he had before when he was like making all of the stories and characters and plots that were going to be in this. You did mention something about Rolling Stone. I was like, they actually like gave this. Like, this was when fucking Rolling Stone gave awesome reviews. And, you know, besides them doing an article on us afterwards, who the fuck knows what they've been doing anyway. But this was like, I was like very, very, very happy to see that. And you guys probably know how I feel about music reviewing in general. But they gave this album a really, really fucking... They were like, this is great. It's one of the top whatever. TJ said the thing. I am afraid. Here's what I'm afraid about. When revisiting and listening to this album, I am afraid that we're never going to get an album like this again. I went back and I was like, God damn it, dude. This is so, so, so specific with the type of person that's recorded, like writing these songs, the time it's done, the manner in which it's done, how it sounds, and how it makes you feel. I am so worried that I'm never going to hear an album that does the thing that this album does to me ever again. And there might be albums that do different things to me, but I don't think that I'll ever feel the same way that I do about an album as I do this one.
Well, I believe Max himself, there was a quote that I read, or maybe Joni found it, but he was saying that he threw all of himself into creating this piece of art, and he said that this is one of the only times in his life that he's ever been able to do that. He abandoned that mindset because basically that's how people fucking go crazy or end up dead at 27. Like, when you completely lose your mind to make art, that's when you make the best art, but it's also not sustainable to stay alive and healthy.
Dude, look, and that is what... Look, here we go. I'm ready for the first, like, thing that I'm probably going to... People are going to be like, fucking idiot. I think he's such a goddamn genius, and in order to be a genius, you have to be nuts. Like, you just have to be. Like, I think that there's no way that you can't do the things that he is doing, taking the risks that he's doing. Look, I'm going to compare Max Bemis to Kanye West. Like, I legitimately believe that in some way, shape, or form, he is that to this. That they're really similar. It's like, because you...
Well, I think they both have bipolar disorder.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the fucking thing, dude. It's like, they took, like, Max takes, like, risks, like, doesn't show up, fucking does weird shit, gets wasted, has to go to mental institutions. And it's not just, like, that outside stuff that you're like, all right, yeah, there are people that are fucking batshit, and then they're, like, just straight, you know, they don't have anything to create out of it. But the people that are fucking nuts... And I say that in the most endearing way, shape, or form. I very much relate to a lot of the things that Max Bemis has and will continuously have. So feel like I'm in a decent place to talk about it. I would say the same shit about me. I would say the exact same shit about me. So except the fact that I'm a genius. I would be like, I am, you know, erratic, and my mood changes. I have drug addiction and alcoholism. I got all those things. And so, like, but I never made a piece of art that I was like, how do I tell that story and, like, make this into something beautiful? All I did was, like, punch light bulbs, you know? Like, fucking, you know, like, that's what I did. And, like, he made is a real boy. And if you are, you know, just a fan of music in general, and you know a little bit about this guy, and you know a little bit about Kanye, I feel like you will start looking at these albums that they did very similarly. And in the same fucking thing, Kanye did the same thing that Max did. He went super fucking, like, Jew core with it, like, in the later episodes. And Kanye did start doing, like, fucking Sunday service shit. Like, I just now started to be like, huh, I wonder what religion is about. I've been alive long enough to be like, maybe I'll read the Bible one day. Maybe I'll do, like, get ChatGPT to explain the Bible to me like I'm five. Maybe I'll, you know, and I started getting interested in, like, war and history. And I think that's just what happens to people when they get older, because they're like, history, you have enough life experience and you have enough knowledge about the world to go, oh, history sort of repeats itself. And there's a reason why these things have been around for so long and lasted the test of time. This motherfucker was 19 writing stuff like this. That is well beyond anything that I was doing at 19. Like, the well beyond anything that I was doing, let alone thinking about. You know what I mean? Like, were you fucking thinking about, like, religion and actually taking such an introspective look at yourself where you're like, oh, I can look at myself with complete honesty and also, like, humility and like, also realizing the and humanity? Like, I wasn't doing any of that. I didn't even think I knew what the fucking word humanity meant.
You know, this is their second album. He grew up in L.A. He's a Nepo baby.
I didn't know
kinda,
that.
Kinda Nepo. Max is he was actually a young little star. He was the baby in Raising Arizona.
That was a fun emo night fact that I just popped into the fucking Slack one day.
So if you look up the poster for Raising Arizona, you'll see a little baby Max Bemis.
Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't know that. It didn't, any, all of the shit that I was like looking up about this album that I was like, what did I already know about it? I was like, let me find some more shit up. I didn't see that anywhere. I think it's like kind of not been a thing that's been spoken about. And it's real. It's real. If you guys look it up, the Coen Brothers movie, Raising Arizona, which is an incredible movie. Like, what a fucking blessing to be on the fucking cover of that movie. You know, like, he is. That's Max Bemis.
But what I was saying is that I think that, you know, growing up in L.A., I feel like it forces you to be older than you are. You're kind of exposed to a lot of things before other people are exposed to it. I think L.A., I would be scared to raise a kid in L.A. because it really forces you to grow up really quick. I feel like this album was written by somebody who is already jaded by the music industry in general.
Yeah, maybe.
At 19.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, if you grow up in that, if you grow up in this environment, you see shit and hear shit about entertainment and music that, like, you're not getting in where we grew up, you know? We're not getting, like, my mom and dad aren't coming home and being like, fuck this agent, like, fuck this shit, you know, like, I can't believe that they, you know, this band wants to put their fucking name above this band, you know, like, I didn't know it. My parents were like, what do you guys want, like, Chinese food, or like, what, you know, like, what do you guys want, did you get in trouble at school today? Which leads me to believe, like, I don't know, like, is it good? Like, that's why I've got such a love-hate relationship with this place. Like, you know, if he wasn't raised here, would we have gotten this piece of art? But also, at the same time, if he wasn't raised here, would he be a more normal dude? You know, like, would, like, who, you know, who knows? And, like, is that the sacrifice that it, you know, you do for like, is that, who knows? What is it? Nature versus nurture? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah. Well, let's jump in a little bit. We mentioned it a second ago, the liner notes here. I found the 10-year anniversary album liner notes online and started reading through it. It was produced by Tim O'Hare and Stephen Trask. Both of them worked on Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which I don't really know what that is, but I think it's a musical.
Yeah, it's a lot of my gay friends love it, and I think why it's because this is, I asked one of them to explain it to me, my friend David, because I was like, you see it all the time. They're like, fuck, you guys always at this goddamn thing.
I thought it was just the fucking owl from Harry Potter.
No. Hedwig is a story about a trans person, I believe. Basically, it's like the Angry Inch is the dick.
Mm.
That's like what that is, and it's like a comedy musical, and they love it. Like, they've been trying to get me to go with them to see this thing.
Got it.
All the time. But
well,
maybe
you should go see it now.
I would, yeah, no, I mean, that would, I didn't know that, because, you know, there's certain things that, you know, when you love an album so much, you start taking a fucking dive into it. But I never, like, gave a shit about who,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
Like, I wanted to know about the songs, and I wanted to know about the artist. I was like, I don't give a fuck who engineered this.
Sure.
And I was like, you know, same thing, like master, which I think mastering's fake.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck who the mastering is on this.
Well, Tim O'Hare has not only worked on the musical Hedwig and the Angry, and she also worked with All American Rejects and the Flaming Lips. One name really stuck out to me on this record, and it was just a name I wasn't expecting to see, and that was Ariel Reichstadt. Do you know who Ariel Reichstadt is?
I know who this is.
No, I don't know.
I mean, should I?
I don't know.
Is this going to be a thing where people are like, Maureen, you fucking idiot, you don't know who Ariel Reichstadt is?
He's won 3 Grammys, I believe. But he worked with all these like hipster bands. Like, I knew him because he worked with Vampire Weekend. He worked with Haim. All these like cool LA hipster bands that were popular like in the 2010s. Ariel Reichstadt worked with them. His credits include Haim, Adele, Beyonce, Madonna, Charlie XCX. He actually has a Grammy nomination for Evermore for Taylor Swift.
Does he really? Wait, so what did he do to this?
He produced Wow, I Can Get Sexual Too.
Really?
Yeah. And I think it's funny too, because, you know, we'll get into the standout tracks and stuff, but we kind of mentioned it on the last episode with Sleeping with Sirens and with Motion City Soundtrack. There was this sort of emo and pop punk was always sort of like looked down upon by the critics and by hipster culture. And there's a song on this record called Admit It, which is just, you know, Max just ranting about how much he feels left out of this fucking uppity, snobby hipster scene. They're kind of looking down on him and his music, and, you know, he's just saying it's all fucking stupid. I thought it was funny because, you know, Ariel, we're like one degree of separation from the most hipster uppity music of Vampire Weekend.
Dude, whenever I fucking, like, I love Vampire Weekend.
Me too, yeah.
I like love Vampire Weekend. I think that,
but when it comes to like pretentious hipster rock, that's the definition.
Look, what I'm going to say is, like, whenever I listen to Vampire Weekend, I feel like they're singing at me instead of to me. Like, I feel like I'm like, I didn't do anything. You know what I mean? And they fucking recorded this in Brooklyn
and Echo Park. It was all over the place. It was like Brooklyn, Echo Park, New Haven. Like, it was all over the place. They were flying all over the place doing this one.
I think in Admit It specifically, I think Max was really talking about the people in Brooklyn the time.
The Brooklyn scene was big.
Yeah, that was probably a little bit before the height of it.
Oh, I think that was definitely the height of it. You had like Cobra Snake, you had like Hipster Runoff, you had all these parties. Yeah, what was that? There was a party that all those guys used to go to in New York that was like a hipster party. Like, Gabe used to go to it all the fucking time. And then it got moved. It was kind of like emo night, but they played like hipster music. But then all the people that would hang out there were just like in emo bands.
What was it?
I read about it in that book, Where Are Your Boys Tonight? I wasn't planning on talking about it, so... excuse me for being
ill-prepared. Doesn't
matter.
Dude, who gives a fuck? I could not be less prepared ever. I made a ton of notes that I'm never going to fucking read, and I'm just going to go off on a tangent about a bunch of shit. Look, to me, Max Bemis is the quintessential anti-hero. Like, I think that he does that thing, and he does it to himself as well. Like, it's a, you know, he's a trying to do the right thing, fucks up, redeems, fucks up continuously. And that's been like, and in through life, and in a lot of ways, like, we are all that. And I think that, but, you know, we're just not making music about it, or we're not making art about it, because everybody is, you know, got main character syndrome, but, like, not everybody has, like, anti-hero syndrome, you know, or, like, which I kind of think that that's it. And it's, like, when you, at least for me, like, when you fuck up so many times, it's just, like, your brain just goes, when am I going to fuck up again? Like, when am I going to do this again? Even if you, like, get on the right path, even if, and I don't have, like, bipolar, you know what I mean? So I don't know what that feels like, but I do know what it's like to be like, all right, sweet, on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens, you don't know how to deal with it, you fuck up, go out of the day. Like, that's what this album really, really, really does feel like.
Well, that's what happened with this record. Like, they Say Anything was poised to fucking blow up with this album, and I think there was a lot of pressure on Max. They had this amazing tour lined up right at the end of when they completed this album. It was supposed to be complete this album, go out on tour with Saves the Day. And Saves the Day was Max's shit. He was so excited to go out on tour with his hero, Chris Connelly.
Buddy, I need a picture of us. Us three together.
Yeah.
Fucking
yeah.
Changed my PFP on everything. I don't give a shit.
But Max actually had a Menti B towards the end of making this record.
He loves having those.
He ended up in the hospital, and he couldn't go on the tour with Saves the Day.
What, 2004?
2005.
What album was Saves the Day on in 2005? You're just quicker than me. I would look it up.
Saves
you're just, like, quicker
the
than
day.
Me. Because I want to, I'd be really interested. I'm, like, want to know what was it.
They put out In Reverie in 2003, and... Wow, they have a lot of stuff.
They do have a lot of stuff, dude.
They have so much
stuff. I know. And the fucking thing is, all of it's good. All of it's really good. It's rare.
They were kind of like in between stuff. They had In Reverie in 2003. They put out this Ups and Downs, which is their early recordings, and B-Sides in 2004.
Which is ultimately, we're not here to talk about Saves the Day, but when we do, I might have to make this like a fucking 2.5 hour podcast.
Well, the tour in 2005 did not happen. Saves the Day went out with other people, but eventually the tour did happen in 2006. Chris and Max would later go on to start a project together, which is called Two Tongues. Do you remember that? Have you ever listened to
that? Yeah, I have. Dude, one of those songs, I think it's called Crawl. That one's the best one. That, like, actually is a fucking, when you put two, I mean, I was like, yes. Like, when I heard that they were doing that, me and my sister were fucking ecstatic. We were like, oh, the two guys we love the most, you know what I mean? Like, doing a thing. I do remember liking the entire album. I don't remember loving the entire album, but I do love that song. Play a little bit of that.
Crawl.
Yeah. I think that that's what it's called.
It is. It has a lot of, has a lot of plays. It has like over 2 million plays on Spotify. Crawl.
There's a good chance a lot of those are me and Marissa.
I don't want to get demonetized.
Like, it already sounds like both of them, which is weird. Like, in just one guitar riff. And then Chris does the chorus.
I gotta listen to that.
It's awesome.
I already love it.
It's awesome. That song fucking rocks, dude. I completely forgot about that because we weren't, you know, I wasn't like doing like a whole Say Anything thing. I was like, all right,
this
album.
Yeah,
I completely forgot about it. It would be interesting to just like do a whole band, like a whole band, but that's a lot. That's like so fucking
much. Now we're here to focus on the CDs, CD burners, right?
We were in Portland the other weekend, and we went into a record store and tried to look for some of the CDs so we could actually get physical copies of them and go through them on the show with you guys.
I ordered what I could off of Amazon and eBay, but CDs are extinct. Like, in that record store, they only had vinyl, by the way.
And also, did we talk about this last time where the Best Buy fucking just wiped it? Yeah. Dude, it's really strange, but there is something. There were tapes. Like, they just skipped CDs. Like,
come
CDs
back.
Are fucking
smoked. We're bringing them back.
Honestly, like, why are, if we're using records, like, why aren't we doing CDs?
I don't know, man, but I think we could bring them back, you know? Remind people how cool CDs were, burning mixes and everything, doing your little Sharpie art.
That is, like, kids,
it'll
kids
come back
today. Dude, man, like, fucking imagine the fucking mixes that you could hand your girlfriend in high school today. You know, like, that would be so sick. That's such a fucking sick thing. I do think that, you know, in a lot of ways, physical shit has come back, but CDs just haven't made it.
They got rid of CD. Do you even have a disc drive? Like, I don't.
No.
Not in my car, not on my computer. Literally, if somebody gave me a disc, I wouldn't know what to do with it.
Dude, I don't think my car has a disc drive.
No. They're gone.
Damn,
crazy.
What a bummer. Dude, remember the one that was like the anti-skip one? There was like the one with the anti-skip and you had the little clear, like there's like a little clear section out of it so you could see it fucking moving. Mm-hmm. That was the shit. I don't think we ever had that one. I think my parents got us like a really shitty one that like, it was like the cheapest level of the, and it would just fucking break all the time.
Same.
You could just buy another one.
Yeah, I used to have the cheap Walmart shits.
Yeah, that's what I had.
So let's jump into the standout tracks because I know there's a lot of them. I have like fucking six of them. I'm sure you have like 10. This is a long album, dude. When I was listening to this, I felt like I got to a, I love this record, but I got to a point where I was like, how is it still going? There's so many songs.
It's
an hour and 26 minutes.
Well, is that the extended version?
It didn't say it on Spotify.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so what I think happened, it ends at Admit It. And then so if you look at Spotify, it should.
Sure.
That's not the last song. Admit It's not the last song,
well,
right?
Wow, I Can Get Sexual Too is after Admit It.
Yeah. So they added another, this is like the extended, and then this was called Was a Real Boy. So I didn't do any of those tracks. Like I didn't do any of those tracks because I stopped it at the ones that I had the album, which was Admit It.
Well, how? You can't.
I know, it's strange. Which is another reason, dude, another fucking Kanye West thing to do is to fucking take and edit your albums like, and be like, no, actually, this is the album now.
My question is, how are they going to do this at When We Were Young? If this album is an hour and 26 minutes, and then some albums like Sleeping With Sirens are like 45, and like, usually everybody's sets at When We Were Young are like 30.
Technically, it's not an hour and 36. Like, technically, it ends at Admit It, which I didn't go into the songs that are after Admit It because I like those songs so much and I didn't want to get fucked up.
Okay, well, I didn't even know.
Good. I'm glad that we learned something. See, we're learning stuff. And I bet everybody, if you just found Say Anything, that you wouldn't know that because fucking you didn't grow up with CDs and you didn't stop there and you just went on Spotify and you're like, oh yeah, this fucking metal now is a real boy, which it's not.
Well, let's jump in to your standout tracks.
Whoa, it's the best track on the album. That is the best track on the album.
It is really, really good. I was listening to it when I just got out of the car.
I mean, but here's the thing. With an album like this, you go back and forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you really go back and forth with being like, oh, what is the best song? It just depends on what mood you're in. I think I consistently go back to Whoa. I always do. Whenever I listen to this album, all the way through, I go, fuck, maybe that's my favorite song. Fuck, maybe this is my favorite song because it's the biggest, most meaningful one that I like. You know, there's so many fucking things you go through. It's not. Whoa, I always go back to Whoa. I'm going to stick with Whoa. I think it is a perfect setup for what the album is in totality, as long as in addition to doing all of the stuff that I like in a song. It makes sense to me looking back that it was supposed to be like a rock opera, because every song is like, oh, there's there's seven parts in this song, you know? And that's kind of what my favorite songs do on the album, the ones that aren't just like verse, chorus, and they do it effortlessly too, right? Like it's an effortless change in a song. Like, and if I forgot what the word that you used last time we were talking, but it's is it the sequencing where it, like, something goes into the next one?
Yeah, that's the order of the tracks. Yeah,
they could, like, I think that Say Anything could split this like into like 25 songs if they wanted to, because like they could absolutely take sections of these songs and make them their own song to make it its.
Well, it's 21 songs.
It's not 21 songs, dude.
You're going to say that he's going to play this album and then not play Wow, I Can Get Sexual Too?
I don't know. When I first heard this album, that wasn't on the album.
Well, my standout track is definitely Alive with the Glory of Love. I fucking love this song. It's so, so good. It is about the Holocaust, which is also crazy because it doesn't feel upsetting. It probably took me, I think I listened to this, you know, hundreds of times in high school, and it didn't hit me until probably 2013. And I listened to it from like 2004, whatever, 2005 when this came out. And then it took me till 2013 to realize, oh my God, this song is about the Holocaust and being ripped away from somebody that you love. And it's really actually super sad.
Doggy, I didn't even know this was about the Holocaust until like 5 years ago. I had no idea. And like, I should know that shit. I had no fucking clue. And then when you go back and re-listen to it, you're like, oh, how can a 19-year-old write the saddest song that has ever been written? And it doesn't sound like that. I was like, oh, this is the catchiest. There's a verse, chorus, the thing that you want to happen.
Well, it's super theatrical. It's got like all these layered harmonies and vocals. You wouldn't know that it's about the Holocaust. And one day I was just putting on my pants, just getting dressed for the day. And I was like, oh my God. And I just started crying. And that was in like 2014. I also have an interesting story about this song. One time in, I think it was 2014 or 15, when we had first started Emo Night, Say Anything was playing a show at the Regent, and they asked, well, Say Anything didn't ask us, but like the promoters of the show asked us to DJ between the bands and after Say Anything and do like a little after party hangout. The whole show happens, Say Anything performs, they come back, they do their encore, and they don't play Alive with the Glory of Love. And everybody was just so disappointed. So you know what I did? I immediately, once the curtain closed, pressed play on Alive with the Glory.
And everybody fucking went nuts. And the thing is like at the time I was like, fuck, it's so funny. Like, how can we not do this? Because it's so goddamn funny to do. It would be like a missed opportunity to not do it. But the way that I felt, you know, like at this point.
Oh, I was so scared to do that.
At this point, like, I don't think we'd met Max.
No.
Like, I don't think we knew Max at all. And so I was like, fuck, this guy's going to hate our guts. You know, like, this guy's going to fucking think we suck. He's going to think it's like a shitty thing to do. Like, did we tell him about this?
I don't think so. But we haven't told him yet, but we're going to tell him when we speak to him at the end of this episode.
You want to know what else I've got? I've got like our K-Rock interview that got dumbed down to 5 minutes, and I think it was like 2 hours long. It was over the pandemic. I think it was like a 2 hour long conversation that I had with him, and I could have gone for longer. But I don't know.
We also randomly today got a preview of the new Say Anything album in your inbox.
I didn't listen to it.
I didn't
because
either.
I didn't.
I was listening to the old one.
I was like, I don't want to get like, I don't want to do the thing where I'm like, oh, this is fucking, and then get sprung on that when that's not my job. And how can this nightmare be my life?
So Morgan, what other standout tracks do you have? Do you have any that you would put on a mix? But let's say you're making your mix. You're making a mix for a girl. You're making a mix for the car. You're making a mix for your trip. What's going on there?
I'm going to put on Belt. I'm going to put on Woe. I'm going to put on The Feudal. I'm going to put on Spider Song. I'm going to put on Every Man Has a Molly.
So you're just burning a copy of
the whole
CD.
Like, it's so fucking hard, dude, because each one of them is so different. And this is another thing. Is we talk about these albums because, you know, they're lumped in the emo genre. if this came out at any other time, like, I don't, or if it was just because of who he was touring with, because I think he did eventually tour this with Dashboard. Like, is it just because he was friends with? Like, is it just because of who he toured with? Because this, like, I don't know if this is an emo album, dude. Like,
who
I,
knows what emo is,
man. I know. That's why I fucking think everybody that's so purist about it is a fucking idiot. Listening to him, like, write a song about watching his cats have sex, and then his cousin on the couch, like, making fun of something, but to tell it in such a beautiful way. I haven't heard lyrics that do the thing that he did in this album in a lot of places. Like I said, dude, a lot of it was funny. I was like, this is like, that's a funny thing to
do. Yeah, it is funny. Like, it's funny, it's ironic, it's horny.
Every Man Has a Molly is like taking a look. He's being so real with himself. He's like, you goddamn kids better be grateful for watching us. You know, like, for watching us play for you.
Yeah, he's like, so you better spend some more money on merch.
And it's like, but at the same time, like, how you could say that that's so surface, that it's so introspective and back to the surface and then back to introspective. Like, it is a wild conundrum, being like, what exactly was going through this dude's head when he was like, I am gonna write this song in this third person view that actually goes back into the first person, that actually goes back into the third person. It is absolutely, it's got to be one of my favorite albums. It's got to be top 10. It has to be.
I would also pick I Want to Know Your Plans for my mix. I think I did put that on our wedding playlist.
It's the second to last song, according to you, right before Admit It. And it is like the acoustic song. It's a love song.
Kind of. Like, all these are kind of love songs.
I have a little bit of a bone to pick on this. It starts with the lyrics, I want to know your plans and how involved in them I am, right?
Yes.
You know where else we've heard that?
Where?
And Max does not have a writing credit on this, so sorry for blowing you up here. Here's the Say Anything one. Okay, got it?
Got it.
First song on the Said the Sky album.
Whoa. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Whoa. I mean, there's.
I think Max should probably have a writing credit on that.
Oh man, did we just start a fucking thing?
I don't know.
We gotta keep it in. Fuck it. I mean, it's important. Like, they're both out there in the world. That's the thing. That is also the thing. Maybe it was done unintentionally, but also fucking said this guy literally loves this shit.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I've learned about EDM and dance music and everything is that, like, it's so much about borrowing from other people and then building on it. And, like, how you present old ideas in a new, fresh way. So I don't think that there was any intention of, like, plagiarism or, like, I'm going to rip this guy off. It's, like, I think that that's sort of built into dance.
No, it's like an homage.
Music
it's an
culture.
Homage.
Yeah.
It's like an homage thing.
It's like sampling.
Yeah.
It's,
you know, knowing Max, like, I think that he would be the kind of guy to be like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
As opposed to be like,
I'm pissed.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, the dude is genuinely an artist. You can hear it in all of this. Like, I think, you know, if we are going to do the extended version, I fucking love Little Girls. I love that. Nobody clipped that.
Yeah.
Nobody clipped that. But I fucking, like, I love that song. And, like, even at the time when I was listening to it, I was like, this sound, I feel like I shouldn't be listening to this.
I know. It's, because, like, kind of inappropriate.
No, it's like, I kill little girls. And I'm like, dude, it's so fucking top level for somebody to just be like, I kill little girls. Like, but that's not the thing. That's not the thing that it is. He does, he has a incredible way of doing that on this album, at least.
Morgan, if you like this, you might like.
Is that
what?
It?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
It can't be.
You have 2 minutes left.
No, no, no.
And then we're jumping into our interview with Max Bemis.
No, no, dude. I have a fucking great quote from him. He did this awesome quote. Let me just say the last quote. Instead of, if you like this, you like something else, I'm going to say this quote because we only have 2 minutes. You have to stay true to yourself, even if there's flaws. I'm not embarrassed to be part of anything. Anyone who has ever loved rock music and told that they were retarded for liking it can identify with Say Anything.
Hell yeah, baby.
He also got in a fucking, like, whatever, your turn. I can't, I'll go on forever with this album.
He got into what?
The fucking, the Tim Kinsella, the fucking dude from Captain Jazz and, like, Joan of Arc wrote, like, a sarcastic, like, editorial about it in Alternative Press, and Max responded to him, calling him, like, a self-hating emophobe. Like,
that's funny.
Yeah, he's fucking awesome, dude. Max rules.
Yeah. Like, it's, emophobe?
Dude, he's so
that's
sick.
That's so good. Well, the album that I said, if you like this, you might like that, The Format Dog Problems.
Yeah, oh wow, that's a great one.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, they're both really theatric. They got, like, layered horns. Well, I don't know if there's horns on this, but the Format album has layered horns. It also has a ton of layered vocals. They're both very musical theater-based. And growing up in high school, I was a musical theater fucking dork. So these two albums really spoke to me. I love how theatrical they are. And if you have never listened to The Format Dog Problems, you are in for a treat.
Did you understood that assignment for sure? That is a really, really great. I don't think anything that I could have said would have compared to it. I really don't. I think that that's, like, that's the best one.
All right, well, let's jump into some of these clips and interviews that we got.
I have a lot more to say about this. Thank you, guys.
Hey, guys. It's CJ. I'm editing the pod right now. The interview we did with Max Bemis, his audio was not great, but the interview was really good. So I just wanted to preface that before we jump into the interview. It is a little bit hard to listen to sonically, but he says some really great shit. So I hope you enjoy this interview with the man himself, Max Bemis.
Oh, dude, we miss you too. How are you? How's things going out there? Where are you?
I am right now in Syracuse, New York, and yeah, things are going amazingly on the tour, which thanks to you guys, like, in no small part. Thank you.
Well, I think
it's an honor.
Thanks to you, you know, you're the guy that, like, wrote all this stuff.
Yeah, that's true. So much work has been done by other people since then, even 20 years ago, to make sure that it's exposed to people. You know what I mean? Like, that's as much work, if not more. So, yeah.
What is the set list like? Are you playing, like, an hour and a half every night?
We are. It's a little shorter than an hour and a half. Originally, we were thinking about playing the Wezzereel Boy EP in full also, which came with a deluxe reissue, and it got re-released by a major label. But it's just too much, weirdly. Like, the songs are sort of long. And I found that the set length, which is like an hour and 20, is actually, like, for instance, the last tour we did before we sort of fake broke up was the anniversary tour for In Defense of a Genre. And we're like, why don't we also play? Because it's, you know, if we split it in half over two nights, it's kind of a short set. So we'll also play Is a Real Boy and self-titled Say Anything album, like, on the nights, you know what I mean, to kind of fill out, like, we'll just split all those four albums up over two nights, which I've heard other bands do, but for me, it broke me, and, like, my voice couldn't take it, like, I was so tired. I was also, I'm sober now, which I wasn't then, and I don't know how I drank. Well, now I realize that when you drink a vat of tequila and, like, have three Red Bulls before you play, it feels really good, but then halfway through, those things don't last eternally. Emotionally, physically, especially when you're 35 years old, now I'm 40, I think it would go worse if I drank a vat of tequila and had three Red Bulls, which was my, like, concoction. Not together, mind you, but certainly back and forth, yeah.
Well, dude, how are you? How you feeling? First off, what the fuck is
going on? I'm great, man. On a physical level, better than I have in a really long time. Emotionally, also better than I have in a long time. But also, that's kind of like up and down with it. Whether it's mood disorder, but like that's not really it. It's more like being 40. I turned 40 like 2 to 3 weeks before the tour, and anyone over. Whatever. I wouldn't even say that. I mean, teenagers. But, you know, it's like you can have the best time of your life, and there could be some other external factors that are maybe not necessarily at their ideal. That doesn't make it not one of the best times of your life. You know, like my wedding was probably the best day of my life if I look back if I had to choose. But no shit going on there. You know what I mean? So I think, but still objectively, I would say better than I've been in a really long time.
Is it weird for you to be 40 playing songs that you wrote when you were 19?
I would say weird in the best way. You know, I it never got, even before the band broke up, it never got to the point for me where I didn't either relate or just appreciate the energy so much that I felt awkward, as people love to overuse the term. I mean, I'm an awkward person, we all know this, but it's more like uncomfortable, or like, I don't want to be doing this, but I'm doing it for money, or like, I'm doing this for you, but I don't believe. Like, I never got there, and then now, it feels even more, I relate to the lyrics more based on some of the stuff that I've been going through lately. It just happens to weirdly, like, you know, synchronicity, the way those things kind of line up, where something from your past lines up with your present, or I'm able to come at it from like a spiritual perspective, where even if I'm, well, the band always had like this meta component of like Bowie-esque, but not at all. Obviously, like humor, the opposite of Bowie, taking it with no seriousness, but making myself into kind of a Larry David type character that was like a character of myself who I'm not. But now I can utilize that with a lot more of a positive and intentioned energy, so that I'm not as confused when like a lyric comes up where I'm like, this is so clearly not something I would say. Or if it is something I would say, something I would not feel comfortable saying because it's not really true, but it's something I think sometimes. Now it's all, I guess the way I describe it, or I was talking to my mom yesterday, and she's like, why is it different? And I'm like, it's because I actually have no fear whatsoever on stage. It's the most relaxed I am in my life, period, right now, is that hour and 20 minutes when I'm on stage. And that was never the case with me. Like, I always was more relaxed, like, reading a book, you know, or something. And it was fun to be on stage, but it wasn't the most relaxed. I literally walk on stage and I'm like, okay. And it's part of the whole thing to me. The performative aspect is to be as relaxed and not stressed out and not overly exhausted, and not killing my voice, not feeling like I'm going to die by the end of the song Admit It, which is the last song in our set and the last song in the album. So it's like, how can I relax more? And then weirdly enough, people have told me, whether it's in my band or friends, that these are the best shows we've played. So I'm thinking it sometimes, but then I don't want to go, these are the best shows you've ever played. As you guys know, you don't perform, even if you think it's the best thing you've ever done or the worst, someone will come up to you and be like, that was the best I've ever seen. And you're like, okay, I guess it was really good. Or, Jesus, I thought it was terrible. You know, so for me, I've sort of had a 50-50 of listening to what people say and then how I feel physically on stage. Because it's really important for me to, like, feel okay, like yoga level, you know?
Dude, so, you know, we're around the same age, and
yes.
This...
How old are you guys? Exactly. I know I'd asked you before, but just in the context of this.
Morgan turns 40 in 5 days,
which is crazy.
God, you look good. God, you look good. Okay. Yeah. What about you?
I'm 34 years old.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, so it is very similar. Yes. But there's a big gap there, I have to say. Like, that was the gap for me, that of when the band broke up versus getting back together.
Dude, that's the thing. Like, I, you know, since we are around the same age, like, when this album came out, it hit me in a way that no other album.
Wow, that's creepy to me that you were so close to my age when I made it and when it came out, and that you even knew it is really cool to me.
Dude,
yeah.
But the thing is like, when we had to go back and re-listen, you know, kind of re-listen and like re-digest.
Yeah, all this,
I found that like no other album that I listened to made me feel as nostalgic as this album in particular. And I'm wondering if like you know, since we are, it's a really strange mm-hmm. age to be, right? It really is a strange age to be. And it's like, are you, you know, when you're going back up there and doing this in full, are you getting pulled back into that nostalgia? And also, is it good or bad nostalgia? Because I mean, I'm like, because there's both. It can be both.
Of course,
you know?
No, of course. I have to say, quite honestly, like, if I were you, yes, of course, it would be full nostalgia. But there are also other feelings being brought up from now. Like, if you're having a sad day and we play I Want to Know Your Plans or something, you're going to have some echo of, like, yeah, I'm feeling that way right the fuck now. And it brings me back, like, my ex-girlfriend from 2004. You know, like, for me, there's no nostalgia. And there never really was when performing with Say Anything. Like, we had to play Alive with the Glory of Love till the end. You know, like, we never didn't play it. It was never... I guess the only negative nostalgia I felt up to the breakup was, like, here comes a while I can get sexual to again. I've sang this song so many goddamn times. Okay, you know, a couple of times, but not heavily. And then we also stopped playing that song a couple of years before we broke up, and I didn't bring it back, but that's probably the only one, but only because it was the closest to like a radio song that we had. The other one,
Morgan and I, it's funny that you say that you,
first emo night DJ, you know, and you're like, God, we've spun this song quite a few times. We're like, take the make, you know, it's like that feeling. But that's kind of, I know you guys, and I doubt that is like common. It's like once in a while, if they're having like a slow night, and like, it's time for my chem. And it's like, you know, we've done this. That said, it's like, to answer your question in full, the thing that really hits me is how no nostalgia is present. It feels like a magical, I mean, I'm into like magic and stuff like that. And my favorite writer is this guy, Grant Morrison, but he's influenced by like Aleister Crowley and those people. But I guess you could look at it way more like, George Lucas level, the horse type shit. You know, like, that's my shit that people take mushrooms and talk about for 5 hours. It's very much so my spirituality. And I feel like this is very much an exercise in that. And for me to go to a place where, especially the negative nostalgia, would have no place in that. Because how could you look at a tour that's doing so well? And like, last night was the biggest show of tour, I think, or one of them, Boston. And it was insane. Like, when I first walked into the venue, it looked like the venues that Weezer was playing when I saw them at that same age come back from the break after Pinkerton, where they gave up. And they're like, we failed, no one liked Pinkerton. You know, 6-7 years later, they came back with a green album and people were obsessed with Pinkerton. And it's not the same situation at all, but it was similar in the sense of the size of the venue and the gap. So I was like, I never thought we would play a venue this big, this deep into our career. So for me to, I doubt either of you would play a venue that big, especially doing something that's like even more of the original stuff you guys put together, and be like, fuck this, we're still here playing with the hand shit. You know, I mean, you'd be like, fuck yeah. You know, and that's mainly what I'm feeling. But then also, like, I try to connect to the lyrics on a pretty specifically like cosmic level. And that really does help me transcend anything that pulls me too far back from like being present. You know what I mean? Like, my mind is really blank in a sort of sublimated state. And then the lyrics will bring up like weird imagery and things that relate to the present and the future, what I want for the future, what I'm trying to, especially the future is actually there more than the past. What am I trying to create for these kids right now? Or kids. When I say kids, some of them are my age, but like some of them are really young there. You know, and my own kids watching and shit. So it's like, what am I trying to impart tonight? What is the service I'm trying to do here? What am I being paid to do? But forget the money. What's my purpose in life with doing this? You know? So if it's nostalgia for the audience, fuck yeah. You know, I see people crying to plans, and I'm like, okay, if it's bringing that up for you, that's good. I'm thinking about changing the lyrics in my mind so they're about the audience or about my daughter who had nothing to do with when I wrote the song, you know?
It's funny that you mentioned Alive with the Glory of Love and how you guys stopped playing it for a second. Because Morgan and I had... There was a moment, actually.
Sorry, I'm just plugging in my guy so it doesn't die.
You guys played a show in Los Angeles at the Regent, and it was before we met. It was like very early on emo night, and the promoters asked us if we wanted to like DJ between bands and do like a little bit of like an after party. Yeah. We didn't even get to meet you that night or anything.
Okay.
But you did not play Alive with the Glory of Love at that show.
I think at that point it was more like an artsy thing. It was like, you know what I mean? Like, I'll still do that, I think, where it's like, you want to hear this? No. You know, it's like, well, precious to me to ever be like, you know, the Holocaust. You know, like, it's like, the Holocaust. I could never be like, we're too good for it. But I think we've probably been like, you know, we play with, like, but it is kind of a good set list call to, like, say, let's say, if you have five really big songs that are like you have to play at every show, you know, maybe leave one out and play with a deep cut.
Well, we were DJing like right after you, and you didn't play it, and then we played it. And the crowd was like pretty stoked about it, but we were worried that you were gonna be mad at us.
Right.
Dude, it was before
We didn't know you.
That would have been someone else making that up. Like, never in my life would that make me frustrated.
Yeah, dude, we didn't know you. We didn't know you in life.
I thought that would have been genius. And also, I've heard of people coming up to me, they don't know how much of a, like, Forrest Gump type simpleton love, like, golden retriever boy I am. And like, yeah, I heard you, like, don't like this type of music or... I heard you, like, the guy from Yellow, Ryan, who I've never met, the singer of, like, Yellow Card. But if someone who worked for both of us, he was like, you know, he's like, Ryan heard that you're not really a fan. Like, no, I rip Yellow Card. Like, no. Huh. Like, I'm just a fucking emo dork, dude. Like, no, come on, man. Like, I'm not Connor over.
Dude, yeah, no, it was before we knew you, and you've been such a big influence to us. We were like, "Fuck, we're gonna take this."
Someone misinformed you.
We're gonna take this.
That was genius.
You know, because we were like, we do funny shit all the time, and we like thought that at the time that was like a funny thing to do.
Funny, that's actually a cool thing to do, and like they didn't get to sing along to that song that night. Fuck yeah, let's sing along. Like they already had a good show. And they get to sing along to a live together. To me, that's genius. So I know that I've definitely never gone through a stage of being in a band where I was that guy. I've gone through many stages of being the guy in the band when it comes to like my offstage shit. But that's mostly self-destructive or just really hating myself. It was never like I'm the cool guy. I just have never been, will never be... Someone said, I said to a friend of mine who was managers at the time, we stopped working together. And I was like, you know, it's just, I'll never be River Phoenix. Like, I can't. And he just goes, Joaquin. I was like, okay, thank you. That's kind of what I hope one day I could go for. Like, I can't be the guy who is too cool for a situation. Like, that would, no, never would I ever, no.
Dude, that's really nice to know because, like, we're, you know, there for a long time we were like, fuck.
I bet someone else saw me chilling backstage, like, and I broke up with, like, my girlfriend that night, and they're like, he looks bummed. It must be because they're playing Alive with Glory of Love. Like, if I was like, oh, they're playing Alive. What? And then someone's like, that means he hates it. You know what I mean? Like, literally, I'm telling you, that is People don't know I'm a simpleton.
Dude, so one of the reasons that we started this podcast was to kind of give people, especially kids now, are starting to either get into emo or get into this scene.
Which is so surreal.
Dude, it's crazy. It's crazy. But I wanted to give, we want to give people a little bit of a snapshot of what 2004 was like for you. And like when this album came out, what that time period looked like for you.
Sure. Well, I was, I wasn't really involved in any emo scene in 2004. I could tell you that much. Like, I was only starting to be. It was already a beautiful scene. Like, I'm sure when you guys talk to someone, like, if you were to talk to Gerard, if you were to talk to, like, Jeff from Thursday, if you were to talk to Get Up Kids, if you were to talk to the Thrice people, like, those bands, we actually had a completely different trajectory than any other band that at least I'm friends with in the scene. I have other friends that have been kind of through similar stuff that we have, like Parker in my band was in Jameson Parker. They had kind of a similar thing because they're from Orange, or he's from Orange County. But we grew up in LA where, we were a band for 5 years-ish before we even had ever toured. We were a local LA band, and we did have a fan base, but we kind of formed our own fan base. There were no other active emo bands. There were no other active, really pop punk bands that we played, but there were pop punk bands in the OC area and ska bands and stuff. But we were a fucking LA band to the utmost, to the point, because I went to like a private school in LA that was mostly like kids of famous people. And there was a scene there, but it was mostly like the band Phantom Planet, the band that's now Maroon 5. Mm-hmm. And we played with those bands. And Rooney, I don't know if you guys remember Rooney, but they were our closest, like, we played the most with Rooney. So, like, you could imagine, that's not the same as being in my chem where you're opening for Thursday for your first couple, you're playing with other bands in this really immersive, self-contained, but, like, there's already labels that are indie, cool, punk labels signing these young kids, saying that they started playing when they were, like, 17 in high school, Equal Vision. So we were not doing that. We were talking to major labels in high school. And then we started to get involved with, like, Drive Through and Vagrant and those labels. But by that time, our parents wouldn't let us drop out of school to tour. So they forced me, essentially, even though I love them, to go to college. And in 2002, I went to Sarah Lawrence. And I was there for like a semester and I could not take it. And I became very depressed and was just smoking weed all day, taking other drugs. And all I wanted was to be on these East Coasty labels that, essentially if I was a young kid playing at that time in Jersey, it would have been natural to show up at a show and you get signed by one of those labels. So I had to use the major labels who are now picking up those bands. Like these smaller emo bands to make them big. It was if I were a 15-year-old getting into emo now and you're starting to dork out about it, because that's how I was when I would discover shoegaze or The Cure in high school and go back, what was this all about? I guess the difference for say anything was that we could have been a corporate manufactured emo band if we wanted to be, but we literally wanted to be like bands that were a lot more genuine, so we had to fight to even get into the scene. And I think a lot of people in bands must feel like that now, with the way that music works, it's so hard to just feel like you're in a natural. So we came up in that MySpace era, and we had to fight to feel like we were doing what we saw the bands we loved do. And so 2004, I had just dropped out of college and I finally found one of those labels to sign me, Doghouse Records, who put out the Kenneth Kids. But they were putting out All American Rejects who were blowing up. And I wanted a different career trajectory. I didn't want to be on the radio, really. I did. I wanted to be a huge hit then, but my biggest want was to be a substantial, cool punk band. And so in 2004, I was making this record almost in a vacuum because I had never toured. There was no punk, like, we had a bunch of EPs and 7 inches on cool labels. No, I was like, this is my only chance to open for Saves the Day. This is my only chance to you know, get into this world. And so I overanalyzed this record so hard and was in a terrible mental health spot. As a lot of people who are 19 are, whether it's drugs or, you know, a mental health thing. And so having that amount of pressure when you're 19 and by yourself, and it's not like this communal cool punk thing, that's kind of why I flipped out. There's enough people on my side going, you know, we love you, but I just met them. Like, they were like these weird big brothers who didn't know me at all. And so therefore, they didn't know I was losing it. They're just like, there's this crazy, kooky kid making a lot of music. Inwardly, I'm like, how could, this is the point of my life. So I guess to that, and I did it in Brooklyn. Brooklyn was really weird back then. It was not what it is now. It was just starting to be gentrified. So it was just a very weird time. It was not the typical story you hear from people in Taking Back Sunday, or, and I'm friends with all those people, so I know that it was pretty similar. Everyone has a special, awesome journey, but this one was like very like Truman Show. And that's why my first manic episode was, it was like the Truman Show.
Do you think that, you know, growing up in LA, having a band in LA, forced you to have the self-awareness that you hear on this album, like that yeah. sort of maturity?
Thank you for, I don't know if it's maturity, but thank you for recognizing the self-awareness. I mean, you can look at it as maturity, and you can say it's almost like a jaded, not jaded, but like cynical in a good way, questioning spirit, and that's why people like it, something like Admit It. You can also say it's also a form of being sheltered, where I was a lot more like Britney Spears. You know, going into an environment where people were just doing normal dude, especially at the time, pretty debaucherous or even cool dude in band mentality, I was a lot more sheltered from it. So whether it was the good stuff or the bad stuff, I was very removed. And as you guys know, did you guys both grow, where did you guys grow up before you moved to LA?
I grew up in,
and I was in Tucson.
Okay, cool. So you, okay, Tucson's a little more like that. But like, because my wife is, you know, from a small town in Texas, and she went through the exact same experience, weirdly enough, even before me, she was on tour with Coldplay. So when I talk to her about her experience of being launched into this, it is really different. And yet she's more intelligent than me. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't say it's and more mature, 100%. She's older than me. And, like more mature, 100% more mature than me. So it's like, it wasn't even necessarily mature. It was like, for instance, I know that when, like, Adam Lazara met someone like Jonah Hill for the first time, he was like, whoa, Jonah Hill! If I met Adam, or if I met someone like, you know, the singer of Lifetime or something, I would be like that to them, whereas Jonah Hill is a guy who I went to school with, and therefore my viewpoint on what people typically call fame or even monetary success, I didn't care about money. I didn't care about, in fact, I was wary of, I wasn't wealthy growing up, but I grew up around wealthy people, so I therefore was like, I don't want necessarily to be rich. It would be nice to be able to take care of myself, but I see this as a corrupting influence. I've always been, I'm now like a staunch anarchist, but I've always been like pretty punk with how I view money. I like it. I also think the way it works in the world is it's corrupt and it's destructive and it's gross. So I think that was there from the beginning, and certainly that plus the exposure to like Hollywood and the major labels. You know, again, the first labels that we ever played for or wanted to sign us were big label, so we have gone through that. Whereas if you were on, you know, Equal Vision and you've never met anyone from a major label and they're suddenly telling you you could be on the radio and shit, that must feel really exciting and scary and all these things. For me, I was like, okay, but that's not what I want to hear about. How can I go on tour with Save the Day, or how can I go on tour with Weezer at the biggest, you know, something like that, you know?
Dude, I mean, the thing is like, I feel very similar to you in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, that album was the first album that I realized that we can play this type of music and listen to this type of music, but be self-aware at the same time. As, dude, you were being, you know, the thing is, it was like, I remember listening back and being like, dude, this guy is funny. This guy's funny. Like, he's
I know that's your sense of humor. I know that about you. Like, DJ, we're still going to know each other a little bit more, but I know that Morgan's sense of humor is very self-effacing and overexposing. So I think that I could see that.
Dude, and that's the thing is, like, did you, like, because ultimately, like, the songs, you did a really, in my opinion, you did a really, really great job of, if people weren't to know you, they would, I don't know if they would take it as humor, because there is a lot of serious shit on that album.
I appreciate that you see it that way, and like, I have people who, so for instance, during, the reason the band, one of the main reasons the band broke up when we did, was because, and I don't fault anyone for this, in fact, I'm glad it happened, because the reason it happened was something that was so beautiful, that it's all I ever wanted for the world, which was me too. And when people started holding people in bands accountable, it was such a hot button thing at the time, but I had always been very bothered by it. It was a lot of the themes inherent in Is a Real Boy were criticizing toxic masculinity by examining the things that I did that were either toxic or I didn't do them, and then exaggerated the things that I did do that maybe wouldn't even be considered toxic. Like, during Me Too, I did the perfunctory thing of reaching out, you know what I mean? Like a girl I hooked up with in 2004. For instance, the girl who Rocking and Sexual was about, who was 1 year younger than me, or 2 years younger, I think. And the song has the lyric, you know, you're too young to be this empty. And what it conjures is, like, a 16-year-old girl on the phone with me, and I'm, like, 25, like, yeah, now you know, bitch. But this girl was 2 years younger than me, and I was, like, 22. You know what I mean? But I still felt creepy. I still felt creepy. I still felt like there was a power differential because she liked my band, even if we were also friends. So I was criticizing this. I don't think that makes me above it. And I learned a lot from Me Too, even if I already believed in a lot of those things. That said, when you have people coming online taking, and there's, like, a meme of Molly Conley being like, that essentially implies that I took a real girl. There was no girl at that point. I had never even had a real girlfriend when I wrote Molly Conley. There was a girl I'd been in love with who didn't like me. There was a girl who I dated and was, like, my first kind of girlfriend, that we had actually a really healthy, nice relationship. But there was no girl who I had rough sex with. I was not having rough sex at the time. But it was fully half a lie, half exaggeration, and it was meant to say, watch out for emo music. It's amazing, but can also be really misogynistic. And I had a friend come up to me, and I was like, yeah, it's been really difficult with, like, people confusing the criticism using a character for who I really am. And it wounds me. It really hurts me to see that stuff on Twitter, because I have daughters. I've always fought for, I'm an ardent feminist, as much as that's cheesy coming out of a dude's mouth. It's very true. And so therefore it hurt. It was like seeing, you know, if someone aligned me with Trump. So I was like, I actually can't take this. And thank God somehow those things aligned where I'm sure you got it this whole time, but not every, like, even some people who now have gone back to getting it may have gone through a period where they were maybe even, like, afraid to sing along to something like that because you could be canceled. Right?
I mean, definitely we have to, you know, we have to stop playing some songs at our event. And it's like,
of course.
And it's like, as much of a bummer as that is because of, like, how, you know, we didn't know it. We didn't know back then. Like, is the thing. Like, you just didn't know. We were just like, dude.
I think that's an important distinction that I hope. I don't fault it for not being considered at the beginning, because, like, when you have people like Weinstein or whatever, like, sorry, Jesse Lacy, out there, like, doing their thing, and they needed a second to be called out, and you had to stop this behavior from being the overwhelming, you guys know this, there was a point where at Warped Tour, you could walk backstage and that shit was just going down. And it was really disturbing. And I remember feeling viscerally disturbed and angered, and it made touring not that fun for me. And that was one of the reasons I quit, was not just me being held accountable, but was being around it. It was really gross to me as someone who got married pretty early, was starting to have a kid, like, I had a daughter. I'm like, I can't be around this fucking shit. So, like, the fact that it got called out And there was a moment of where, like, but now that there's enough distance, let's say 5 years, I do think it's time to, it was cool. Haley played Molly on, like, her podcast or whatever, her little, like, thing that she does. Because it's not a full podcast. I think Will, not because she's little, but because it's, like, a little thing. But she doesn't have a full podcast. I think she has a radio show. But she played Molly Conley, and she said something like, I know that some people can see this as problematic now, but I just think it's really real. And the irony was, as much as I love her, it's not that real. Like, in context, I wasn't being that honest because I didn't want merch money. I didn't want, there was no Molly Conley, but it is real in terms of what my criticism was with what was going on. So maybe it is the kind of time where you could have me on the show without it being like, there's the guy who wrote Molly Conley Brock. You know, so maybe there's other stuff like that. You know, who knows? You know, but certainly we don't want to be playing Lost Prophets. You know, like, there's a line.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a commentary on the scene and the state of the scene, and I think a lot of people maybe that just goes over their head because you're seeing in the first person.
They're a victim. You know, to be fair, I think. That's why I don't mind it. That's why I don't think the meme is funny. I just think that I had to then take responsibility for being a dude or whatever and go, you know what? I'm not going to go on there and be like, write a diatribe about how this is not a real person and I knew this was funny and it was ironic. Like, I was like, okay, you get your shit in. You deserve it. We've been raping and enslaving women for all of human history. So I think I could take a fucking joke. You know what I mean? That said, that doesn't diminish my humanity as a person where I'm like, I'm not going to go out and be like, yeah, I am a bad guy. Because I don't think I'm that kind of bad guy. I have my own shit, but that's not it. Yeah.
I mean, I feel pretty goddamn similar to you, dude.
I know.
But I want to like, you know, just this, because, you know, this is about this album in particular. And, you know, we did as much research as we can for just two dudes that are pretty fucking dumb and don't know, really know how to do a podcast. So it's like, you know, I just.
You guys are great at it.
When you were, you know, is there, looking back on this, like, I view this as a perfect album. I view it as a perfect album, oh, man, whatever you say. You know,
what I was trying to do. Like, I could never say one of my albums is a perfect album, but I put enough work into it with the goal of making it. And that's a couple of our albums are like that, where it's very centered on being an album, you know?
Well, it's like, you know, not only just like, you know, it's a difference between like, yeah, I think all of the songs are great, but I think at the time it was exactly what I needed when it came out. And so there's a lot things that can make a perfect album for somebody in particular that might not be, you know, it's different, like what people consider a perfect album. And so, like,
every album, like, for me, Jesus, I don't know why what is that that it just did? It just became horizontal. Let me see if I can adjust this, sorry, because I've been, like, fucking with it the whole time and it's fucking with me. I need to get it to be good. I'm so sorry. This is like trigger warning.
But have you gone back and like listened to, you know, like, do you, what, how do you view this album? How do you ingest this album when you go back and listen to it? Or you're like, fuck, man, I wish I could have changed that. Or if I wish I could have done this different or like,
I agree it perfectly did what I meant to do with it. Whether that makes it a perfect album for any given person or in general at all is subjective, like any art. So, you know, I wouldn't expect that you played it for any given person and they'd be like, yeah, I get it. But for the people that I wanted to get it, it did. It resonated perfectly. It created the perfect effect for my career. When I talk to people, like right now, they pick up on the themes that I wanted them to pick up. I structured the album intentionally. What's the first song? What's the second song? And it was written in narrative order, you know, which I started to do a lot over the course of my career. Not every album, but a lot of my albums are track listed and even sometimes written in order. So this was, you know, it was our first album, but I had done, you know, that album Baseball in high school and done a bunch of those demos that are now kind of floating around. And those were not written necessarily. Maybe in the back of my head, I'd go, this could be a single or this could be the first song on the album. But that's just like most bands. Some bands will sit there and really make a concept album. Almost every Say Anything album is a concept album. And this was the first one. And it's up there in terms of our discography of full concept albums, in terms of how obvious it is that it is a concept album. But it was written, I was writing a, we hired, one of the producers of the record is this guy, Stephen Trash. And he produced Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which was this amazing indie cult musical. And he was hired mostly because he knew how to make a punk musical. Because we were writing dialogue. We were making a script. And it just didn't get used because we didn't have enough time to put all that together. And so it ended up being a narrative without talking. It's basically an opera without talking. You know, it's an opera. Operas don't have talking. So it's like a musical without talking. There's an actual story that connects all of it, and I could walk you through it one fun day. And it's actually, I think, in one of the early books, maybe the Doghouse booklet, it talks about this story, which is about someone kind of based on me, but he's a worse person, and it tells that story. So,
like, I mean, I view this album as more of a piece of art, honestly, is the way that you can look at it. And that's why, you know, in my opinion, it's like, you know, up there with my favorite albums of all time, because, you know, every time you listen to it, you're like, I pick up on something different. This means something different to me than when it did when I was X years old.
Well, that's why right now I was saying that there's no nostalgia, because seeing it is, as a performer in general, like, for instance, I'm making new music right now, even newer than the new album that's coming out next month. And when I listen back to, like, something I even just made that day, I'm listening to it on multiple levels. And I'm picking up on stuff I didn't need to do, which happens a lot with songwriting. If you're sitting there writing, especially because I do a lot of stream of conscious stuff, consciousness, whatever, stuff, like, there's lyrics that are poetic in a way that I didn't intend, and they and then everyone will come up to me and be like, oh, so you meant this? And I'm like, actually, I literally was speaking gobbledygook that just seemed to make sense to me at the time and felt like poetry. It's not always the case. A lot of it is really intentional, but there's lines that don't make sense. I mean, the song Belt, the first song, is very weird and abstract, and a lot of the imagery makes more and more sense to me over time. Why did 19-year-old Max put that together with, this is something I have to do for myself? Why does this whole song make sense as an entity when it seemed pretty abstract when I was writing it? It was like, I was high, and it was like random. Now I can do that, not high, thank God, but like at the time I thought I needed to smoke weed to do that, you know? And so it was just a lot of pulling it out of the weird psychedelic ether and, you know,
It's interesting that you mentioned Belt, because I think that, you know, that I go back and forth. You know, you can catch me on any given day and be like, what's your favorite song off of this album? Mm-hmm. But I always catch myself going back to Belt as being my favorite song off
it's
of the album. Mine,
it's probably mine too.
Yeah, it just has every...
So, like, that was the point where, and this is kind of I don't know how much I've said this, but it was a turning point where I was writing all this music that I was like, I really like this. Like, for instance, A Walk Through Hell is like one of our more favorite B-sides from that era. Or even I Want to Know Your Plans, which ended up on the album, was written like 2 years before. I was 17 when I wrote that song. But when I wrote that, I was like, I think I'm now in the band that I want to be in. I was like, something changed in my life that made me write the song. And thematically, it's about, on a very literal level, it was a song I wrote to help me motivate myself to drop out of college to pursue music. So this is something I have to do for myself. Sorry, Mom and Dad, you want me to be studying?
It's a lot like, you know, if I could tell somebody to be like, all right, listen to, you know, if they're like, what is Say Anything about? I think I would
sure.
Listen
to that.
Listen to Belt, you know, and you'll get it.
Even to this day, it's kind of true. Like, with the new stuff that I'm writing, I want to say that it's, like, something off one of my later albums, you know, or what I just wrote yesterday. But it was, like, a statement of purpose, you know. It was, there's a reason that I, it's kind of weird that we have an album before, but I, you know, adamantly say it's our first record. And that's kind of pretentious of me. But it is true that that song was the turning point. I remember right where I was. I remember writing. I just picked up an acoustic guitar and just played that riff out of nowhere. It's not like I was sitting there figuring out the chords. What can I do to be artsy? What can I do to make it a little more mature? Like, it just came out of me. It was kind of angry and angular, and it was based on all the stuff I was listening to. And it just, I just started singing and playing it. And a lot of my songs are written that way, but it, you know, and then after that was like Alive with the Glory of Love and Woe, and they were kind of written in that general order, but Belt really did serve as a turning point in my life where I felt like I could actually tour with the bands that I looked up to, and they might be like, damn, this band is pretty good. Have that feeling is a, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that, where you're like, I think that I'm on a new level. Like, I said it on this tour. I leveled up. I peaked at that moment, and then hopefully there are other peaks, but that was definitely the peak of the time. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Max, we don't want to take up too much more of your time. Thank you so much for
always with you guys. Yeah.
Is there, you know, and then just like, you know, I always want to just try and ask this one thing, you know, as we're talking about this album in particular, like, if there's, you know, if there's one thing that you can say about this album that you maybe haven't said that people don't know, that you're like, I would like the world to know what that is about this album in particular, anything, you know, there might not be, you know what I mean?
So one thing that I may have said some of this before, but in context is new because it couldn't have been said before, because this is as of today, you know, or as of this tour thing. It's like, you know, it was written to be a satire. It was written in character. Belt wasn't as much, but it became that. Once I wrote Belt, I was like, okay, that's a little bit, like, not me, but it is me. How can I go with that more? You know, like, it was a mixture of this criticism of myself, my actual feelings, and then, you know, I'm motivated. I've always created art to help people. Like, from the beginning, even at 6, 7 years old, I made comic books. That was the first thing I did, and I wanted to be some form of a creative superhero and just help people get through their lives, because I saw so many people around me hurting in my own home, my friends, myself, and I just wanted to create something that would help people. And it did take me until this tour, obviously, I think, to go, you know, yes, it's written in character, but as an example, when I had my first manic episode, I'm bipolar, for any kids who don't know that. So, like, when I had my first manic episode, where you sort of, like, dissociate from reality and you think things that are not true. You don't see or hear anything necessarily. Some people have schizoaffective where you see or hear things. For me, it's just thinking thoughts that are so far out there that you're like, I'm Jesus or I'm an alien, whatever. I'm going with it. So, like, not just having that thought when you're high and, like, or having a really good day. Like, really going with it for at least a few hours until someone puts you in a fucking hospital and is like, no.
I'm right there with you.
But for anyone who's listening, you know, like, there's a lot of misperceptions of the disorder. So for me, one of my negative ones, the positive one was, I'm in the Truman Show. I've been raised as an example. People are watching me. I'm now going to escape the set. And I did, in a weird spiritual cosmic way. You know, that was what happened. I stepped out of a box that I painted myself in my whole life, and I felt free for the first time. I was, like, woken up. But on the negative end, because there's ups and downs to it, I actually thought I was going to get executed for making the album. This was before it came out. I thought I was going to be killed for making it, because I thought, at the moment, I'm like, this could create the worst world in the world. Like, this could create another Hitler. Because if they take it seriously and take it literally, all these terrible things that I'm saying about, like, in Yellow Cat, Red Cat, like, we're all terrible, fuck the world, scummy, crummy day, and these are, you know, like, there's an acceptance of, like, darkness on the album. But now in context, I can sing those things and it's less like a character. I don't really see him as that negative. So like even something like The Feudal, which is about suicidal ideation, you know, those are my first feelings of like wanting to die or, you know, anything like that. Now when I sing it, I've been through that stuff in the past 5 years. It's kind of been normalized for me. And also the world has gotten better about normalizing mental health issues and suicidal ideation and bipolar and these things. So I feel like it's, I don't know, I guess I would say that the thing that people should know about me is that I no longer like think it's that much of a like cheeky, ironic thing. And I think if you relate to it, don't feel bad. Just know that we all relate to these fucked up, and you don't have to be bipolar to relate to the thought of wanting to die. You don't have to be in a band to relate to the feelings that I'm singing about on like Roll, where it's like I'm in an art gallery and people are staring at me. You don't have to have that exact experience to relate to these extremely overwhelming, anxious, dark feelings. We probably all can relate to it. And when I look out at least the thousands of people that I see every night singing along, and therefore it's really redemptive to me to go like, you know what? Like, even at its worst, it was never like evil. You know, it was never dark. It was mostly just a negative view of something that I later rephrased as something positive. And even by the end of the album, by admit it, it's seen as a positive. You know what I mean? Like shitting on hipsters, but then shitting on myself. You know what I mean? And saying I am a hipster. Like, that's not dark. That's good. You know, it's good to have self-awareness. It's good to not put yourself above other people, but not take shit from people who are going to tell you that you suck for it. So, yeah, I guess that's what I would say about it.
Dude, I'm going to be excited to talk to you about this album in another 20 years and see where you're at on it.
Are you guys at home? Are you guys going to get home when we come through?
I'm not sure. We have a lot of traveling this summer, too. But
I mean, I'll do my goddamn... We
get you guys to a goddamn show.
Yeah, definitely.
And we can have you play... We'll leave out a lot... That's the only time I could see you guys getting in trouble, is if we leave out alive on the anniversary tour. And we're like, fuck y'all, emo night's playing it. But I'll say that, and then they won't know it's because I'm mad at you. It's because we didn't fuck with everyone. Yeah.
Let's go, dude. I love we love you so much.
Use that, Morgan. Let's go to my vocab after you. You gave me let's go.
We love you so much. This album changed my life and my sister's life and like everybody I grew up with was a big deal. So I want to say thank you for all of the art.
You're very welcome, and thank you for being someone to help expose it to people, like, A, even at that time, to your sister. Like, don't undermine that part. Sure, you're also doing this incredible thing, playing it so many nights for people and sponsoring this tour, but the people who just gave it to their friend, you know, like, that's epic, and you were there doing it at the beginning.
All right, awesome, brother.
Dude. Well, don't hang up, because it might take a second to upload. So I'm just going to stop.
That would suck.
Yeah. All right.